Madhava Kunja Vihare. Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parvraja Gachara Sotara Sada Shri Shimra's Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Samave Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai Gaur Pimananda All glories to assembled devotees All glories to assembled devotees All glories to Shri Guru and Shri Garanga Jai Prabhupada Namo Vishkaraya Krishna Sandhya Shri Mati Bhaktivinoda Swami Maharaj Shri Sarasarindra Is this loud enough? Can people hear? Okay, there's someone up there. Shout. Okay, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. We're in Canto 3 now, Chapter 1, and we're covering texts 5 through 8 today. So I'm just going to read through 5, 6, and 7. You can do the Sanskrit and English, and then we'll do 8 together responsively. So starting with text 5. Okay, should be Sutta Vacha. Sutuvacha sevam rishi varyo yam prishto radya parikshita prayaha tamsabahu vit ritatma shriyatimiti. Sri Sutta Goswami said, the great sage Shukadeva Goswami was highly experienced and was pleased with the king. Thus being questioned by the king, he said to him, please hear the topics attentively. 6. Sri Shukuvacha Yadata Raja Svasutana Sadhun Pushnan Nadarmena Vinashta Dristi Praturva Vishtaya Sutan Vibandun Pravesha Lakshya Bhavane Tadaha. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, King Dhritarashtra became blind under the influence of impious desire to nourish his dishonest sons, and thus he set fire to the lacquer house to burn his fatherless nephews, the Pandavas. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Dhritarashtra was blind from birth, but his blindness in committing impious activities to support his dishonest sons was a greater blindness than his physical lack of eyesight. The physical lack of sight does not bar one from spiritual progress, but when one is blind spiritually, even though physically fit, that blindness is dangerously detrimental to the progressive path of human life. 7. Idasabayam Kurudeva Devya Kesha Bimarshan Sutta Karma Gayam Yavaryamasa Lipashna Shunya Svarshraya Hrantya Kutakum Kumani. Translation. The king did not forbid his son Dushasana's abominable action of grabbing the hair of Draupadi, the wife of the godly king Yudhishthira, even though her tears washed the red dust on her breast. And text 8. Let's do this responsibly. Jitetva dharmena jitasya sadho. Satya valambasya vanam gatasya. Naya chito dat samayena dayam. Tamo dushano yada jata shatro. Jutet vadarmena jitasya sadho. Chatya valambasya vanangatasya. Navachito dat samayena dayam. Tamo jishano yada jata shatro. Others chant. Thank you, word for word. Jute. By means of gambling.
By means of gambling.
To. But adharmena, by unfair tricks, jitasya, of the vanquished, sadho, a saintly person, satya avalambasya, one who embraced truth as shelter, vanam, forest, gatasya, of the goer, na, never, yachita, when asked for, adat, delivered, samyena, in due course, dayam, right share, tamajusana, overwhelmed by illusion, yet, as much as, ajata shatro, of one who had no enemy. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Yudhishthira, who was born without an enemy, was unfairly defeated in gambling. But because he had taken the vow of truthfulness, he went off to the forest. When he came back in due course and begged the return of his rightful share of the kingdom, he was refused by Dhritarashtra, who was overwhelmed by illusion. Report. Maharaj Yudhishthira was the rightful heir to his father's kingdom, but just to favor his own sons, headed by Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra, Maharaj Yudhishthira's uncle, adopted various unfair means to cheat his nephews out of their rightful share of the kingdom. At last, the Pandavas demanded only 5 villages, one for each of the 5 brothers, but that was also refused by the usurpers. This incident led to the War of Kurukshetra. The Battle of Kurukshetra, therefore, was induced by the Kurus, not the Pandavas. As Kshatriyas, the proper livelihood of the Pandavas was only to rule and not to accept any other occupation. A Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya will not accept employment for his livelihood under any circumstances. Om Jnana Kimrandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurun Nintamina Tasma Sri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpa Purvishcha Kripa Sindhu Devacha Patitano Avanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Prabhupada. The section of Srimad Bhagavatam is beginning the conversations between Vidura and Maitreya, and that has been mentioned right at the end of Canto 2 and beginning of Canto 3. But actually, the conversation between Vidura and Maitreya does not begin until the 5th chapter. So we have 4 chapters in between the actual conversation takes place. So what happens? And this isn't to a spoiler or anything. I think everybody's pretty familiar with the story in the Bhagavatam. But just to get kind of a feel of what's happening, the background, of course, is that Vidura, being insulted by Dhritarashtra and others, leaves the court. And of course, he's the half-brother, considered a Shudra, of Dhritarashtra and Pandu. In his travels, going off on pilgrimage, he'll meet Uddhava. He'll speak to Uddhava for some time. Uddhava will then spend about a chapter talking about the pastimes of Krishna and Vrindavan, which is really nice. Then Vidura will ask Uddhava will become basically a spiritual master and instruct him, because he knew that Lord Krishna had directly spoken to Uddhava. And of course, that's the 11th canto, right? There's 20 chapters there of the Uddhava Gita before he left the planet and entrusted knowledge to Uddhava. But Uddhava refuses because he's junior. Vidura at this point is like the age of Uddhava's father, you know, at least. And so, but he refers him to Maitreya, who it says is also, I don't know if he was actually present with Uddhava or was another time, but he was also instructed by Krishna directly before Krishna leaves the planet. So he was a completely suitable person, and therefore we'll have long, several many chapters of Maitreya's discussions with Vidura. So that's kind of what's happening. So right now what we've just seen, these last few chapters, is explaining a little the background of why Vidura is going to be leaving the court. And first, what's being described is some of these events perpetrated by Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana and Dushasana that led up to the Kurukshetra War. And there's two purposes here, I think, at least I'm thinking for these verses here. First of all, it's the incidents that will lead up to Bedur leaving and going on pilgrimage and later meeting Maitreya. So we have to have his background of why he left. But we also see this very, very important, interesting contrast between the actions of the Kauravas and the quality of the Pandavas. And that's described particularly in the verse 8, with the last verse we read, which I'll discuss more. So the incidents here described by Dhritarashtra, Yona, and Dushasana really show the lower qualities of the Kauravas. It's described a couple of verses ago that Dhritarashtra is physically blind, but worse than that, he's spiritually blind. And Prabhupada says, being physically blind would not prevent one from spiritual advancement. You know, no physical condition would. But being spiritually blind was much worse. Why was he spiritually blind? He didn't accept the will of Krishna. Krishna clearly showed what he wanted to happen. He did not accept that. And he did not respect Krishna's dear devotees. Not only did he not respect them, he tried to kill them. First of all, he usurps the kingdom. He's, of course, Pandu was the rightful emperor. I guess he's the emperor of the whole world, really. But anyway, the rightful ruler was Pandu. Pandu dies, and therefore it should go to his sons. Now, his sons were still children, so they have to usually have a caretaker, or what do they call it?
Guardian.
A guardian, yeah. And Dhritarashtra should have acted as their guardian, helping them and assisting them to become qualified, you know, when they became adults. Instead, he saw this as an opportunity, move them aside and bring his sons, including his firstborn son, Duryodhana, who was so, what can I say, so completely unqualified. Wasn't there a voice from the sky or something when he was born saying you should actually almost kill this child, he's so evil? No. Anyway, so this was Dhritarashtra's mentality. He wasn't necessarily evil himself, but he had this huge, huge fatal flaw he had of being so attached to his own sons and couldn't understand Krishna, couldn't understand his devotees, the Pandavas, and what was really right. And so therefore he tries to, what's mentioned here, is he tried to burn them in this house of lack. Basically build a nice house for them, have a man and it's all covered with shellac, which, you know, would be very flammable. So then they put it on fire, but of course they escape. And he tried many ways, many different ways to kill them. And one of the most important incidents, there's one other incident that is specifically mentioned, which is so critical to the whole story and also showing this difference, and that was the disrobing of Draupadi. And that was, of course, instigated by Dushasana. Now, Dushasana was the second son. The younger brother of Duryodhana was Dushasana, and Dushasana is the one who actually physically dragged her, although encouraged by specifically Duryodhana, the other brothers, and Karna. Karna was very envious. Why? Because he wanted Draupadi's hand in marriage, went to the Swayamvara ceremony, and she says, no, you're not really a Kshatriya, because of his the lack of clarity in his birth. And so she rejected him, really, not because she really cared that much, but he was such a good archer. She wanted to make sure Arjuna won, because she wanted to marry Arjuna. It was as simple as that. So he was always had this enmity towards Arjuna and towards Draupadi. So he was very happy to see this humiliation or attempted humiliation of Draupadi as well. Now, as we all know, it's such an important story because it shows how one must totally surrender to Krishna and Krishna will protect one in all situations. So Draupadi, of course, was in great distress. Nobody's helping her. All the crew is just sitting there. You have Bhishma and Drona, great devotees actually, saying nothing. And you have the Pandava brothers can do nothing because Yudhishthir, who was, of course, great, great devotee, great ruler, it's called Dharmaraj, one who knew all religious principles, I guess by the arrangement of Krishna, had one fatal flaw, gambling. So he ridiculously gambled away everything, gambled away themselves, gambled away the kingdom. He even put up his own wife and gambled her away. So she then became the property of the Kurus. Now, but what did they do? Try to disrobe her in a public, take her clothes off in a public assembly? This is abominable. This is disgusting. I mean, this is like unheard of for Kshatriya Dharma. They're supposed to be protecting women, you know, not. And you know, this isn't some woman off the street. This is the wife of the king, an empress. Her father was a king, Drupada. I mean, so I mean, this was just, and of course, then she realizes she can. No one's going to help her. She tries to resist. These are Kshatriyas, huge, strong men. She can't, what can she do? She holds up both arms, surrenders to Krishna, and say, I can only surrender to you, Krishna. Please help me. And he does. Of course, we all know he gives extended, unlimited lengths of cloth. Sorry, they completely kept her covered until they finally became exhausted and couldn't continue any longer. Now, would that be the end of it? Because, I mean, after all, Krishna protected her. That's really wonderful. They should all feel great. No, these are Kshatriyas. They don't forgive and forget easily. They are very strong Kshatriyas. Draupadi's a Kshatriya. So Draupadi basically says, I'm not even going to comb my hair back until I can wash my hair in the blood of Dushasana. And pretty strong, you know. And Bhima says, yes, I vow to fulfill your vow. Something like I'll rip his heart out and drink his blood or something. I don't know exactly. I'm not a Mahabharata scholar. But it was something quite... And tear his hands off, I think, while he was at it, because they touched Draupadi. But because, you know, they were foul. They foul her purity. This is a tremendous sin carried on. And I'm not going to get into the gory details, but let's just say that Bhima completely fulfilled his vow. And that was the end of Dushasana and one of the most gory, things in the Mahabharata. Now, not only that, Bhima personally himself killed all 100 sons of Duryodhana. So here is somebody who is a little bit irritated, and you do not want to get Bhima mad like this. So, he killed Dushasana, killed Duryodhana. We know in that famous last club battle at the end. And Dushasana killed the club. I think the other 98 he actually killed with arrows or whatever. But anyway, and of course Arjuna wasn't too happy about this either. And he took revenge by killing Karna and actually even Bhishma. It's a great devotee. I mean, you need a little help with that in Krishna, but, he did. And it's not just that, it's not just these devotees and their kshatriyas and their hot-headed or something. No, this is the will of the Lord. And in fact, it's described, here we go. Let's see. Krishna says, Bhagavatam 1:15:10. Well, it was described about Krishna. It was he only, meaning Krishna. It was he only who loosened the hair of all the wives of the miscreants who dared open the cluster of your queen's hair. That's Draupadi. In other words, Krishna decides at that point, you have so much offended my great devotee that these 100 sons, they will all be killed. That's what it means, that his wives would have their hair loosened, which means they're widows. At that point, he decided they're all going to become widows. They're dead. And Bhima simply was the instrument in doing that. So this was the will of the Lord. You cannot treat Krishna's devotees like this and expect there will not be some repercussion. This also directly accelerated the Kurukshetra war. So obviously it's all arranged by Krishna. It's all part of it. He has incredible plans and who knows everything. But anyway, this accelerated the war. It got rid of all, made sure that we got rid of all of the Kauravas because they had Arjuna and Bhima gunning for him now. Now, this is all stated here in just a few verses. But then we have this last verse, this contrast with Yudhishthir. Yudhishthir is basically cheated in gambling. He's cheated out of his kingdom. He's consigned to the forest for 14 years, right? When he wants to come back, what does he want? Well, we need our kingdom back now. No, you don't get it. Duryodhana says, okay, finally he says, just give us 5 villages. Because we're Kshatriyas, we have to have something to rule. Just give each one of us a village. No, you cannot even have one village. You can't have 1 inch of ground. We're giving you nothing. So, Prabhupada is saying here, this brought upon the Kurukshetra War, and it was due to the Kauravas, not anything that the Pandavas had done wrong. Not only that, but we see a contrast with the mentality of the Kauravas and the Pandavas, and particularly Maharaj Yudhishthir. Now, in this verse, Yudhishthir is called Ajatashatru. That's, a very, very important word. It's the main word that I kind of got out of this that I wanted to talk about. Ajatashatru means one whose enemy was never born, or one who has no enemy. And Yudhishthir is called this, I was trying to look up 6 or 8 times in the Bhagavatam. He's given this name. It's almost like a name like, like in Arjuna's called Dhananjaya or something. It's almost synonymous with his name. One whose enemy was never born. So he's a very, very advanced devotee. And kind of this meaning of Ajanta Shatro is a really nice description of it in Prabhupada's purport in Bhagavatam 3:25-21, which is, this would be Lord Kapila Dev, I believe, speaking by this point in the third canto. The verse is, Titikshiva karunika suhrida sarvadehinam ajata sutrava shanta sarva sarubhushana. The symptoms of a sadhu are that he is tolerant, merciful, and, again, the word ajata shatru, friendly to all living entities. He has no enemies. He's peaceful. He abides by the scriptures, and all of his characteristics are sublime. And Prabhupada says, the sadhu is the most compassionate personality towards the fallen souls. One of his qualifications is karunika, great mercy to the fallen souls. While engaged in his preaching work, he has to meet with so many opposing elements, and therefore the sadhu has to be very tolerant. Someone may ill-treat him because the conditioned souls are not prepared to receive the transcendental knowledge of devotional service. The sadhu has the thankless task of impressing upon them the importance of devotional service. Sometimes devotees are personally attacked by violence, and then Prabhupada goes on and gives examples of Lord Jesus Christ, Haridas Thakur, Nityananda, etc. He says, the devotees of the Lord are merciful. The cats go out to everyone, cats, dogs, trees, etc. Treats every living entity in such a way they can ultimately get salvation from this material entanglement. Although the sadhu is not inimical towards anyone, the world is so ungrateful that even a sadhu has many enemies. So, just as Yudhishthira, although he didn't consider anybody an enemy, people considered him an enemy. So this is a great example of Vaishnava compassion. The Vaishnava compassion is such that they want to relieve the suffering of others. And that is how they are such a true friend and kind to every living entity. Spiritual compassion is true kindness. I mean, this differs from sometimes in a mundane way we think of compassion as doing good deeds or being sympathetic to a person. Giving nice words, friendliness, or philanthropy. These are all basically actions in sattva-guna, in mode of goodness. And this compassion, spiritual compassion, is actually based on bhakti, is on the shuddha-sattva platform, the platform of pure goodness, which is above the three modes of nature, including goodness. So one can only become a true friend of the jivas through shuddha-sattva. Because this is completely on the spiritual platform. So we want to make sure that we don't, sometimes even as devotees, we can become attracted to the mode of goodness, because the mode of goodness is attractive, and it creates happiness. When one acts in the mode of goodness, one becomes happy, even in the material and pure world to some degree. And so sometimes we could even get ourselves caught up in mode of goodness lifestyles or different issues, or we become attracted to mundane charity, helping others materially. Now, those things are not bad in themselves. It's not that there's anything wrong with those. We should act in the mode of goodness, but it should not take prominence over Krishna consciousness and acting on the pure platform of bhakti yoga. So all of those activities in mode of goodness, which we must live in, and you'll see many verses even that says the devotees in the mode of goodness, they should be adjuncts to our service to Krishna and to our preaching mission, and not supplant them. That's the idea. And actually, Prabhupada says in a purport, September 3rd, 1975, he says that we have to transcend the material qualities, even sattva-guna. But a Vaishnav is also a Brahmin, which means situated in the mode of goodness, of sattva. So Prabhupada says that nobody should come to the platform of shuddha-sattva without being elevated to the sattva-guna platform. So in other words, one needs to be situated in the mode of goodness to be able to transcend the mode of goodness and be on that pure goodness or shuddha-sattva platform. And it's intrinsically connected with our spiritual life. Therefore, one who is in the spiritual consciousness, shuddha-sattva, doesn't see enemies. They see equally the equality of all living beings, and they serve, of course, the mission of Lord Chaitanya, or Sampradaya, and Srila Prabhupada, which is all based upon this principle of compassion and not on friends and enemies. And, of course, that compassion really is different. Sometimes people think of compassion like empathy or sympathy, but it's really much more than that. Because it means not only seeing the suffering of others, being able to have some understanding of that, but also the knowledge and the willingness to be, want to try to relieve that suffering. So it's not just, you know, not just saying that it's unfortunate that people are suffering, but we have the knowledge, the abilities, we have the practice, we have Krishna consciousness, something that can be given to the living entities to help them relieve their suffering. So this is, of course, one of the divine qualities of divine nature, listed in the 16th chapter, Bhagavad Gita, Dhaya Bhuteshu, mercy towards all living entities. So it's a deep awareness of the suffering of others. And if we're just a little introspective, every one of us has experienced suffering, seen suffering, the entire world is suffering in so many ways. If one doesn't think there's suffering in the world, then I don't know exactly where you've been living, you know, what your experience has been. And there's a nice verse on this in the 10th canto, 10:10-14. It says, by seeing, it's an awareness of suffering of others. It says, by seeing their faces, one whose body has been pricked by pins can understand the pain of others who are pinpricked. Realizing that this pain is the same for everyone, he does not want others to suffer in this way. One who has never been pricked by pins cannot understand this pain. So obviously it's an analogy of the material world. That we've suffered in the material world, therefore we can understand it. We can understand the sufferings of others, and therefore one naturally wants to take away this pain from others. Now it's interesting, and this is a little bit of a side, but Krishna, being completely pure and perfect, of course, and is always situated in his own happiness, he's Atmarama, doesn't really experience personally the pain of the material world. Right? Although he has compassion, he understands it, of course, and he has mercy. But that mercy is extended generally through his devotees. His devotees living in the material world who are kind of like right in it and can understand a little bit more the experiences of the jiva souls. And, I mean, there's a lot of reasons, but he also just wants to give nice service to the devotees and they can become glorified by their service of preaching all over the world, etc. So at any rate, the compassion basically means we understand the suffering of others, we see outside oneself, not becoming so preoccupied or self-centered that all I can see is my problem and what I'm going through. But we also have that desire to relieve the suffering of others. Now, we have, of course, the best example of this problem, so many great examples. One good example, I should say, is Prahlad Maharaj. And he talks about this idea of friends and enemies very famously. In 7.5.12, Prahlad Maharaj says, when the Supreme Personality of Godhead is pleased with the living entity because of devotional service, one becomes a pundit and does not make distinctions between enemies, friends, and himself. Intelligently, he then thinks every one of us is an eternal servant of God, and therefore we are not different from one another. And Prabhupada says in the purport, we are actually servants of Krishna, eternally. But under the influence of the external energy, we think we are separately situated from the Supreme Personality of Godhead as friends and enemies of one another. Vaishnavas say that since everyone is a servant of the Lord, everyone is on the same platform. Therefore, a Vaishnava treats other living entities neither as friends nor as enemies, but instead tries to spread Krishna consciousness, teaching everyone that we are all one as servants of the Supreme Lord. Of course, seeing this oneness of all living entities is usually characterized as the Uttamadhikara, or the topmost platform of devotional service, that we are all servants of Krishna, because everyone is. Every jiva is originally a servant of Krishna, and of course is now deluded by coverings of material nature. So, even if we're not on the Uttama Adhikari platform, still, one should strive and try to become at least Madhyama Adhikari, which means that one serves the Lord, one serves senior devotees, the Guru, one makes friendship with those equal to oneself, or one's peers, we could say, and shows compassion to the innocent living entities. And, of course, ignores those who are demoniac. But this, all of us, even if we're not at the highest platform, should try to show this true compassion, and that's helping others advance in Krishna consciousness. And of course, again, Prahlada Maharaj prays, "My dear Lord Shingadev, I see there are many saintly persons indeed. They are interested only in their own deliverance. Not caring for the big cities and towns, they go to the Himalayas or the forest to meditate with vows of silence. They're not interested in delivering others. As for me, however, I do not wish to be liberated alone, leaving aside all these poor fools and rascals. I know that without Krishna consciousness, without taking shelter below his feet, one cannot be happy. Therefore, I wish to bring them back to the shelter of your lotus feet." And these are such incredible high sentiments. You know, I wish I could think that way. I'd say, I'm out of here, you know, probably. Not thinking, I'm not leaving until all other living entities are also free from this material world. So but this is something to strive to, at least aspire to. At least recognize that, you know, this is the wonderful, lofty sentiment of the great pure devotees of the Lord. So why is it another reason? Why is a devotee a friend of all? Because Krishna is a friend to all. Krishna is called in the Bhagavad Gita, 5th chapter, Suhidam Sarvabhutanam, that he is the dearmost friend and well-wisher of the living entity. And his desire is for us to return to him, not to suffer in the material world. And because he has this quality of compassion, we, as his small part and parcels, also have part of that quality. So we try to fulfill that and understand what Krishna's qualities and Krishna's desires are. Another verse, 9:29, Krishna says, "I envy no one, nor am partial to anyone. I'm equal to all. Whoever renders service unto me is in devotion, is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him." So he's equal to everyone. He's not partial to anyone. But then he says, "But one who is my devotee is a special friend." Is that being partial? No. It's reciprocating as the living entity desires. If you desire to be Krishna's friend, if you desire to be Krishna's servant, if you desire to once again develop your relationship with Krishna, and Krishna completely reciprocates in that way with us. If our desire is to not recognize Krishna, to try to enjoy, lord it over, everything, experience this material world, he gives us that full facility as well. So not partiality, it's just reciprocation in kind. But he particularly is attracted to his devotees who want to serve him, and he becomes their dearmost friend. And of course, that friendship and love and compassion for all conditioned souls was most manifested most strongly in his appearance of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Lord Chaitanya was called the most merciful incarnation of Krishna by Rupa Goswami, Namo Mahavananaya Krishna Prema Pridayate. Most merciful, Mahavananaya. And what did he give? What did he come to give us? Krishna Prema. He gave a simple process of chanting Hare Krishna and gives us the absolute highest realization of Krishna Prema and all the advanced processes, and displays his most wonderful personal pastimes as Krishna and Vrindavan. So here we have, you know, what a display of mercy. What to speak of course, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes in the form of Krishna, but not in the form of Krishna. Comes as Krishna in a different form, as a form of a devotee in the mood of Srimati Radharani. It says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he takes on the color and the mood of Srimati Radharani. And what is her mood? One of great mercy. She is the most merciful. Lord Chaitanya came in that mode of mercy of Radharani combined with Krishna to not only, of course, he had his internal reasons of experiencing that ecstatic relationship between Radha and Krishna, but also to, you know, to bring about the Yuga Dharma of Sankirtan Yajna, of chanting the holy name. So he inaugurates the Sankirtan movement for the purpose of delivering the Jivas in Kali Yuga through chanting, which allows the living entity to once again experience Krishna, be non-different from his name, to become purified of material desires, and experience a taste of that relationship, a taste of the bliss that is there, that we can recapture, we can re-achieve, we can have once again with Lord Krishna. So, of course, there are obstacles to complain. We might think, why don't I feel this way all the time? Only rarely do I feel paradukha dukhi. I'm only unhappy by the unhappiness of others. Otherwise, Prabhupada said, I'm completely satisfied. But when I see others unhappy, then I become unhappy. Again, very, very advanced. But at the same time, it's a very good sentiment, not sentiment that way, but a very good expression or internal spiritual feeling to meditate upon. It's kind of like, you know, this would be ideally how one should, you know, appreciate other living entities and our duty for them. And what prevents that? Mostly absorption in our own happiness, absorption in our own affairs, our, you know, everything that we're involved in day to day. And so if one can't really step outside of oneself, and by self I don't really mean the self, I mean the material body, gross and subtle bodies, then it's difficult to have this compassion. So we need to develop it, first by hearing. That's why we hear about the great devotees. That's why the Srimad Bhagavatam tells us about Prahlada Maharaj and so many other Narada Muni, so many wonderful, compassionate devotees. And we have to develop conviction and faith. Our faith has to become strong. When we understand that Krishna is actually taking care of us, that even when we have difficulties, Krishna is always there. He's there in the heart. He's protecting us. He's giving us guidance. He's always available to us as our best friend. Then naturally we would have a desire to want everybody to experience that. But we also have to have humility. Pride is the greatest hindrance to our, false pride is the greatest hindrance to our advancement of Krishna consciousness. Many of our acharyas say this, you know. And when we are proud, then that's almost the opposite of compassion. It's the opposite of humility. And compassion can only really be there when there is humility. And of course, we need to continue practice. We practice the process of Krishna consciousness and also attempting to preach. And I don't know, I'm sure every, I can't imagine that probably every devotee's experienced this, that when we take a little bit of effort, we take that opportunity to talk to someone about Krishna, or some of you are like very active, distributing books or whatever, you know, very much more of a platform. But when we do that, we experience it. Krishna actually gives us realization from then. The more we try to surrender, the more we try to do those things that will be pleasing. In other words, do we act on a platform or think of a platform beyond our actual sort of, our own adhikari, our own actual abilities or our situation? Yeah, to some degree. But that's how we make advancement, by acting in Krishna consciousness. By, you know, it's kind of like, I know one devotee who was a very, very good manager and tended to be a little bit, some people thought he was a bit arrogant, but, you know, not always. But he said to me once, I know I'm not humble. He says, but I try to act humble. Because if I try to act humbly towards devotees, he says, someone is going to seep through, and I actually might start feeling that way and actually do that at some point. And that makes sense. You know, in other words, we want, which is what we do. Sadhana bhakti is the practice of devotional service. Everything we're doing right now is bhakti devotional service in practice. Now, what do we do when we become advanced and it's no longer, we're beyond the practice stage? A lot of the same things. Hearing, chanting, remembering, serving, right? So in other words, it's not that the activity changes so much as the consciousness. So we are doing the activity. What is different than what we do in hearing, chanting, remembering than the residents of Vrindavan were doing when Krishna was there? They were always hearing, chanting, remembering Krishna, serving Krishna, right? Thinking of Krishna, offering prayers to Krishna, etc. So we're doing the same activities. And through those activities, the mind, the consciousness, the heart is becoming purified to the point that more and more we're really understanding and feeling that. And we are feeling first the compassion of Krishna and Radharani, the compassion of Srila Prabhupada, of all the great acharyas. And then with a little bit of that that we experience will give us some strength to be able to pass that on to others. So thank you very much. My glory to Srila Prabhupada. Any question? Yes, Mother Gamika?
Prabhu, could you give an example or two of how, as devotees at if we engage in an emotive goodness activity, but it takes prominence over devotional service?
Well, I mean, I've seen some of these devotees get very involved in a particular. I've even seen, you know, devotees getting involved in some type of system. You know, like they go to some seminars, you know, maybe, and they're teaching these things, which are good things to have, or good ways to act, or to interrelate, or to understand oneself, these kind of things. But no, and I'm making this as a slight criticism. You have to remember, as one who is a psychologist, who has probably done a lot of this myself. But still, we can't think that those things are like the real answer. They may be a short-term fix for certain things, and some people need that. I mean, sometimes you have to help people work with very basic skills, like communicating properly with other people and things like that, but for a purpose, so one can make further advancement. And so I guess it's a matter of, you know, not having, or sometimes people get very, very involved in whatever it might be, being a vegan or being into ecology or, you know what I mean, environment, and which is fine. We want to be that way. We want to show that kind of example, you know, to the world. But we know it's not our inner drive, right? I mean, it's not what we're really at and what we really are trying to accomplish, because, I mean, people can be in the mode of goodness. I've known people follow all the four other principles who are agnostics. I mean, you know, it's like, so in other words, what's the mode of, that basically, the four other principles place us in the mode of goodness. But and that's the platform, it's the foundation for spiritual activities like chanting 16 rounds that actually cause spiritual advancement. Okay? So that's what I'm saying. We don't want to get too involved in the mode of goodness activities, which are really just the platform for the real practice of Krishna consciousness, which is going to really give, you know, purification to heart and happiness. Right? Is that okay here? You may have some examples, I don't know.
One should not over-endeavor in such a way that one's devotional service is sacrificed or diminished in any way. Mm-hmm.
Niyamagraha?
Yes. It just made me think how that may also be a way to see this other thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes that means like not following rules and regulations, or placing too much emphasis on rules and regulations and not understanding the meaning behind them, kind of. But also, there's also other verse about over-endeavoring for material things which are difficult to achieve, things like that, Prabhupada said. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? That's right, Prabhu. I mean, Panchagoda. Sorry. It was okay. It wasn't any bad.
So we're talking a little bit about humility. But Yudhishthira Maharaj and the Pandavas, although wanting to set a good example, when it comes to maybe being an administrator and or trying to rule, how does that humility kind of fit into that picture, in the sense that you know, it's good to be humble, but at the same time you have to conquer and or also maybe establish your position, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I struggled with that for about 40 years from doing management.
Only 40?
I think every manager does to some degree, because it is difficult. We can see. Now, look at the example of the Pandavas. They tried everything they could. You know, I mean, talk about, you know, Arjuna was willing to accept 5 villages. In other words, and then finally they tried everything they could, and finally it was like, enough is enough. Now we go to war. You know, yeah. And so, I mean, I guess it's, I don't know if that's a good example or analogy or not, but we do everything we can to do things, especially the problem that with managing in ISKCON is we're dealing with devotees. So we have to be very careful, right, how we treat devotees. And, you know, it's possible to make offenses to devotees. Now, I've always felt that if one had to say something negative or chastise someone or whatever, if it was in the pursuance of one's service that was given to one by legitimate authority and down from Srila Prabhupada, And not for the purpose of self-aggrandizement or make myself, you know, life, you know, better or easy or anything else, but really was for the benefit of hopefully devotee, but at least of the greater good of devotees or the temple or whatever. Then you have to do it. That's the service. There is Kshatriya service, and Kshatriya service means to make decisions and to rule. It's there. And it's there in our movement. And, you know, it's like sometimes people, I have this nostalgic idea that, you know, well, when Prabhupada was here, you know, he just kind of made everything right, took care of everything. But the reality is, we all had to deal with very, at that time, immature leaders, right? I mean, we've all experienced that. You know, they were 22 years old and hadn't had a lot of experience being a temple president or something like that. And they didn't always do the greatest job, and Prabhupada generally supported them, right? For the most part, Prabhupada asked us to follow that, because there has to be a system, there has to be even in a society, there has to be a rule of law, and there have to be people who do that, you know? And again, I think the challenge is to always balance that sense with, just as Yudhisthira did, or Dharmaraj, he knew all religious principles, to balance it with, how do I most help the devotee? You know, what can I do that's for the benefit of the devotee? Because even, I was thinking of an example, I just lost it, how even, well, we know even like Krishna, you know, always acting for the best, he kills a demon, the demon gets liberated. In other words, you know, so in other words, the idea is to always try to work for the greater good. And sometimes Krishna would end up having to dispose of someone so they didn't create further offense to devotees, like blaspheming or whatever, you know. So, you probably have more insight than I do. Do you have some ideas on it?
I have no clue.
More experience, perhaps, with a more recent experience than I do. You know, but it is a challenge, right?
I think all we can do is pray, chant the holy name, and increase our Krishna consciousness, and we'll understand what humility is after some, you know, Krishna will reveal how to do.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Even if it seems like a struggle, I am convinced that Krishna sees the struggle, he will reward us. He will give us that advancement or give us that understanding. And I found I didn't appreciate a lot of this until after I retired. You know that. Yeah. I actually started to like devotees more. The problem with we are in any position we're in is a tendency. We don't exactly see friends and enemies, but sometimes we can see those devotees which are helpful and cooperative, and those devotees that are a problem. Right? There's two categories: problem devotees and non-problem, or maybe even helpful devotees. No, they're all devotees, and they all need to be helped, you know. But and at the same time, you got to keep things running. You have to do Prabhupada's service, and you have to. And Prabhupada wanted a lot from us. He wanted us to manage well, right? Do things well, and that's not always easy, you know, with volunteer workers and limited resources. And of course, you are all wealthy in India, but here we experience it. You know, so much is harder. Okay. Anyone else? Oh, nice to see you, Prabhu. And we're so happy to see you here.
Thank you, Hare Krishna. Just a comment on the topic of sharing Krishna consciousness with others. One of the byproducts is we get back a realization from the people we share that we never thought of. And I feel like that a lot of times, you know, you just wonder, oh, I didn't think it that way, you know. And you get a lot of benefit from other people's realizations. Mm-hmm. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's a good insight. Okay. Others? Okay. Thank you. Thank you all very much. I'll go to Srila Prabhupada.